The third part of my talk, the hope is to go 20 minutes, 20 minutes, 20 minutes, because I don't want to be invited to give a second follow-up talk, which is the tradition here. So if I go over, then be, you know, hard on me. The third possibility is there's something dynamical going on that is not a cosmological constant in the sense of actually being a constant. There's plenty of seats back here in the corner, guys. So I'll just say, for the purposes of the outline, the possibility is the lambda is a function of time. But of course, if it is a function of time, it's not the cosmological constant, it's something else. But there can be things which mimic a cosmological constant, which are dynamical, which change as the universe expands, and there's plenty of theories. So there's a lot of theories here and here which we would have to talk about to try to explain the observations. I should also say that one of the themes, I said that, you know, it's good, it makes me happy to be able to explain something that is real and that is not just a misinterpretation of data. Happiness is going to be one of the main themes that runs through the talk. I think that this result is making a lot of people happy. It's good for a lot of purposes. A manifestation of this is that I'm very happy to be able to talk about theories in this talk for more than half of it. The last couple of talks I've given at the ITP have mostly been about data and observations. And, you know, I don't want people to get the wrong idea about me. Some of my best friends work with data all the time. I try to be very open-minded about lifestyle choices like that, but I have a reputation to uphold. Nevertheless, I will start by talking about some of the observations which have appeared in the news media recently, and I will give you the inside scoop. To talk about the observations, you first have to understand the theories in which they are contextualized. All observations are theory laden, and to understand why certain observations are particularly exciting, we have to understand what the theoretical background is. So the theoretical background for this is Friedman, Roberts, and Walker cosmology. If you believe in general relativity as Einstein invented it, and you also believe that the universe is homogeneous and isotropic on very large scales, which observation seems to indicate that it is, then you're driven to the fact that the universe is described by a Roberts and Walker metric, which is a certain geometry of space-time. There's only a small number of choices for what it could be. The choices are, there's two things you have to specify to say which Friedman, Roberts, and Walker universe you live in. One is the geometry of a space-like hypersurface, space at a moment of time, and then the other thing is how that space at a moment of time changes with time. So there's going to be the space-like geometry, and there's going to be a scale factor which tells you how that space grows. We know that it's expanding right now, so it's changing with time. So the space-like surfaces have three possibilities for what they could be. They could be a spherical geometry, in which case the curvature of the space-like surfaces is positive, and we say that the curvature of parameter k is plus 1. The second possibility is that space at a moment of time is flat. It just either goes on forever or it can wrap around itself like a torus. Well, I'm not going to tell you what the topology of it is, but at any one point, it's flat everywhere, and we say that the curvature parameter is 0. And then you can guess what the third possibility is if you didn't already know it, namely that the curvature is negative, in which case the space at a moment of time looks like this. I was practicing last night. In this case, in the old days, you would have said this looks like a saddle, but these days it's more evocative to say that it looks like a Pringle, you know, the potato chips that curve in one direction one way and in the other direction the other way. I didn't get a Pringle to bring in, so I tend to eat them before the talk.
We still play saddle in Kentucky.
Well, you'll get into 20th century someday, don't worry. These pictures are of space at a fixed time, and then as time goes on, the relative size of these geometries changes. So these are multiplied by a scale factor A as a function of t, and the second thing and final thing you have to specify to understand which Friedman, Roberts, and Walker universe we live in is what that function of time is, A as a function of t. So if here's time and here's A, what we know observationally is that right now the universe is expanding, so it looks like this in our very local neighborhood, and we know that in the past the universe was essentially zero size. We see the microwave background, we see light element abundances, which are consistent with a very small, very hot, very dense universe. So we say that if you extrapolate this into the past, you have to hit very close to A equals zero, certainly close enough to say, for our purposes today, that A was zero. But we don't know what the future was like, and we don't even know what it was between here and here. The possibilities include that it expanded, but more and more slowly, and will eventually recollapse. that it expanded, but more and more slowly, but it won't recollapse. It just gradually asymptotes to something which gets infinitely big, and then that it was expanding in the past more and more slowly, but then had an inflection point, turned around, and is actually accelerating now. All of these are perfectly consistent with observation. We would like to decide which one of them is true. The way to do that is to start writing down equations, having written down the pictures. And the first equation is Friedman's equation, h squared, which is defined as the time derivative of a over a, which is the Hubble constant, square it, and set that equal to 8 pi g over 3 times the energy density of the universe. Everything is homogeneous and isotropic, so at any moment in time, the energy density is the same at every point, minus this curvature parameter over a squared, where this curvature parameter is this number, which we can, by coordinate choice, set equal to 0 or plus or minus 1. So this is a constraint equation, and it will look in a prettier form if we move this term over to the left-hand side and divide everything by h squared, in which case I can write it as 1 minus omega sub k equals omega total. And what this means is that I've defined omega k to be k, I think minus k, yeah, minus k over a squared h squared. I just divided everything by h squared. And omega total, which is known as the density parameter, is 8 pi g over 3h squared times rho. So omega total can be any number, a real number. If it's less than 1, then by plugging into this equation, you're going to see that k has to be minus 1. If it's exactly 1, k is going to be 0. And if it's greater than 1, then k is going to be plus 1. So omega total, the density parameter, the how close we are to being at this critical density where k is 0, is something we would like to measure. Omega sub k looks like a density, but it's just a notational thing. I'm going to put it in quotes. It is not actually any stuff that you could measure out there. It's sort of a measure of how much density is missing between the actual density parameter and 1. Okay, so that's fair. So the question is, rho, to measure what omega is, if we know what a squared is, which we don't, but we're pretty close, we would like to know something about rho. And regardless of what the actual value of rho is, we'd like to know what kind of stuff makes up rho. So the density, for an arbitrary thing, we will write that rho I will change in different ways as the universe expands. For ordinary massive particles, we know that as the universe expands, the number density of massive particles will go down, and their energy density is just their individual masses times their number density, so their energy density is going to go down. So in general, we will write that rho sub I for any kind of stuff I goes as a to the minus ni for some number ni, where, for example, the matter energy density, rho matter, is proportional to the a to the minus 3, because it goes down as the volume. The number of particles just gets less and less. Similarly, the energy density in radiation, which to a cosmologist, radiation is just any sort of relativistic particles. It can be legitimately massless particles like photons, but it could also be ordinary massive particles as long as they're moving close to the speed of light. The equation of state of those two things is essentially the same, so we're not going to distinguish between them for cosmological purposes. And here, once again, if you consider photons, the number density of photons goes down as the volume, but also as the universe expands, the individual energy of each photon goes down because they redshift. And that goes as a to the minus 1, so the whole thing goes a to the minus 4. In other words, n sub matter is 3, n sub radiation is 4. Now, just as I defined what looked like a curvature parameter for nothingness, for the amount of critical density that we're missing, I can define rho sub k, which is just defined to be, if by comparing this equation to this equation, rho sub k, I didn't write it down, but you can see what it is, divide this side by 8 pi g over 3h squared and get it and plug that into here, what you find is that the effective density and curvature goes as a to the minus 2. So the usefulness in writing this equation is that you can compare how the amount of curvature that you have in your universe catches up to the amount of radiation and the amount of matter. If omega curvature today is close to omega total, and omega total is, let's say, made of matter, then in the past, when A is much smaller, the energy density in matter was much greater than this, so omega matter was essentially 1 in the past. That's why it's sort of funny if omega curvature is comparable to omega matter today, because they change in different ways as the universe expands. A final interesting possibility is that empty space itself has an actual energy density. And by this I don't mean the missing energy here, I mean energy which is present in empty space that has an effect on the gravitational field, which we call the vacuum energy. And by definition, if that's in the vacuum, it doesn't depend on any dynamical mechanism, then that does not change with time. So omega rho vacuum, I should say, is proportional to a to the zero. And in fact, this is physically indistinguishable from a cosmological constant. So for future reference, I'm going to write this as omega sub, or rho sub lambda, the energy density in the vacuum, the energy density in the cosmological constant. Those are the same thing. So we like to distinguish which of these is actually the stuff that dominates the universe. There will also be more exotic possibilities, which I will get to later. But to do that, we look at another equation, which is a double dot. This is the actual evolution equation. 4 pi g over 3 times the sum over all the kinds of stuff that make up the universe of 2 minus n sub I rho sub I, where n sub I is defined by down here. Okay? So if we knew the kinds of stuff that made up the universe, we could tell what a double dot was, and then we could get a handle on which one of these was going on. Or vice versa, by measuring this curve, we might be able to get a handle of what kind of stuff dominates the universe. So the possibilities are, if you look at that equation and compare it to back here, and for this curve, a double dot is negative. It's less than zero. The thing is turning over with time, and that means that n is greater than 2. The energy density in whatever stuff dominates the universe falls off faster than the scale factor of the minus 2. This is the conventional case, because it applies if the universe is either matter-dominated or radiation-dominated. This case, where the universe is taking off, has a double dot positive, and therefore, by looking at that equation, the only way to get that is to have n be less than 2. The only possibility of those over here is the cosmological constant. So if the universe is actually accelerating in expansion, and this is the stuff that makes up the universe, then it has to be a cosmological constant, which is the most important contributor to that equation. If you don't get any change in the expansion rate, if it's just a straight line right now, then that would be interpreted as a curvature-dominated universe, an open universe in which the matter density was very small compared to the critical density. So what we'd like to do is to, given this knowledge and the interpretation we've given to it of this curve over here, measure this curve as a function of time to try to get a handle on what makes up the universe. That is something that intrepid souls have been trying to do for years and years and years with very little success, especially, I mean, their lack of success is correlated with how much publicity they get for the campaign. But things have changed now with the Type 1a supernovae observations, which is what I will try to explain to you right now. Well, let me actually babble about what that means. I refuse to ask for another hour, so I'm just going to have to talk faster, and you're going to have to listen faster. A type 1 supernova is what you get when you take a white dwarf and you slowly dump matter onto it, for example, by having a nearby companion, which is overflowing its Roche lobe and accreting and throwing matter onto the white dwarf so that it accretes. Eventually, the white dwarf will get sufficiently massive that it is at the Chandrasekhar limit, and therefore, the electron degeneracy pressure cannot keep it stable anymore. It will collapse and explode. And you see a bright flash, and that's a type 1a supernova. I should probably write that down. We write down SNE, because the plural of supernova is supernovae, and it's type 1a. There's also a type 2, and there's a type 1b, and 1c, and so forth. And we're just going to talk about type 1as. Because the Chandrasekhar limit is essentially universal, it doesn't matter what the environment of the white dwarf and so forth is, the brightness of the resulting event is essentially universal. So these type 1a supernovae are close to being standard candles. They all have approximately the same brightness. That's the kind of thing you need to observe how this curve is changing with time, because the supernovae are very bright, brighter than the galaxy in which they live, typically, and they're approximately the same brightness. So when we observe them far away, we can measure their redshift. We can find out how the redshift changes as a function of time, which is related to this curve right here. The problem is that they're not exactly standard candles. In fact, when you look closely at type 1a supernovae, they vary in magnitude at peak brightness by more than one magnitude, which is not nearly precise enough to do this observation carefully. But a leap forward was made recently when it was realized that the variations in absolute brightness of the type 1a supernovae formed a one-parameter family which was correlated with the length of time that it took them to fade after peak brightness. So this is a set of curves. And here are data from different type 1a supernovae, and here are some templates that would just fit with them to them empirically. And what you see is that the absolute brightness at peak can vary from minus 19 to almost minus 17, almost 2 magnitudes in brightness, which is a huge difference by the precision of these experiments. But if you compare them, you see that the one that is getting the brightest at peak also takes the longest to fade. So if you were able to get observations of the light curve as it changed with time, this is in days, so up to 100 days, it's not really very long, you would be able to go backwards and figure out how high it was on this graph, and therefore get a very accurate determination of how bright it was. These are nearby supernovae, yes, for which you could independently measure how far away they are and therefore their absolute brightness. The claim is that the precision with which you can know the absolute brightness after you correct for this is on the order of 0.05, so much better than the order of 2 magnitudes that you got before it. Nope, just empirical, sadly. But that just means that theoretical astrophysicists will not be unemployed anytime soon. So since these are bright and now we can understand how far away they are, their absolute brightness, we can try to do this project. This was work done only in the last couple of years, and the space telescope is a necessary instrument for actually observing these guys since they're so faint. So only in recent years has it become possible to do this, and two groups have taken up the challenge.
There's plenty of untested
assumptions.
Well, aside from the fact that there's one primary family of the same pattern should apply in large.
That's right.
And there are different chemical composition differences.
What you can do is try your best to test it. The single most obvious difference in high redshift supernova to nearby supernova is the fact that the universe has a different chemical composition, as you say, at high and low redshifts. So what you can check is, in the nearby supernovae that appear in regions of different chemical composition, do they fail to fit into this pattern or not? And that has been done, and as far as anyone can tell, it is independent of the chemical composition in the region where the supernova is happening. They all do seem to follow this pattern, up to this accuracy of 0.05 or 0.06 magnitudes. You don't know what the chemical composition is in the early universe, so we don't know. But it's expected to be comparable, yes. As far as theories go, it's expected to be comparable. Some of them are in elliptical galaxies, which are, you know, have all their dust processed, and some are in spiral galaxies. They're very, you know, they are shameless about where they appear. So to the best extent that we can test it, it seems okay. I use we, of course. We is nonsense. I have nothing to do with this. I am not on either one of these groups. The one group is the Supernova Cosmology Project, known incorrectly as the Berkeley Group. Saul Perlmutter, the leader, is actually at Berkeley, and most of the people are at Berkeley, so it's not completely wrong, but there are non-Berkeleyites there. The High Redshift Supernova team, which is completely incorrectly known as the Harvard Group, is led by Brian Schmidt, who's not even in North America. He's in Australia. His ex-thesis advisor and the noisiest member of the collaboration is Bob Kirshner, who is at Harvard. That's why he is... But only three of these people are actually at Harvard, even though many of them were graduate students or postdocs at Harvard. As I say, I have nothing to do with this, although I have the inside scoop on the data, which I will show you in a second, because Brian Schmidt and I were office mates in graduate school together. And in fact, I was a year ahead of Brian, partially responsible for recruiting him to Harvard, so I like to think that without me, the whole thing never would have gotten off the ground. But I don't know if that's the conventional wisdom among... Also, all of the papers by this group have Perlmutter as their first author, so they're easily identifiable, but these guys are more anarchic and they like to switch around. The most recent actual paper that appeared was Garnovich et al. A lot of the data analysis papers are Schmidt et al., and the paper which will appear soon, which causes all the ruckus in the news 2 weeks ago, will be Reese et al., Adam Reese. Much younger person than I am. I don't want to talk about how uncomfortable that makes me feel. So this is Reese et al. This is the stuff that Brian sent me an email, and he told me that I was not allowed to actually Xerox it and give it to anybody upon pain of being hurt. But I could show it in a talk, so here it is. Here is the Hubble diagram, the magnitude difference between the absolute and observed magnitudes of the supernovae versus redshift. And you can compare it to three curves, one of which is a flat universe, matter-dominated, one of which is an open universe with only matter, and one of which is a flat universe, which is dominated by a cosmological constant. And when you blow things up so you can actually see the differences, this is the same data, just on an expanded scale. Here's the flat universe with matter dominated, with matter as its essential component. Here's an open universe, omega is 0.2, and here's the cosmological constant dominated universe. You can see that the individual error bars on the points are approximately the distance between these curves. And they're all centered on this one. But if these are just formal errors, they're certainly consistent with being taken from a Gaussian distribution. You can determine the center of that distribution very accurately. And it's very, very close to this curve. It's many sigma away from this curve.
One sigma error?
I wouldn't know. There's no paper here. This is sort of samizdat information.
I'm bothered by the fact that there's a gap between the two points, right? The two groups of
Oh, yeah. Well, these are old. These are not the high redshift supernova project. These are just the ones that supernova used to calibrate the distance scale.
Right.
Why do you find these?
No, there's nothing in between.
Well, your search strategy for the more recent stuff will only find very, very high redshift supernovae because they're looking at only a 1 square degree area of the sky, and in that 1 square degree, there are many more high redshift galaxies than low redshift galaxies.
So presumably there's an effort to fill that
media. No. I mean, the resources used here are extraordinarily meager. So if you, any time you look for a supernova here, you're not looking for them here. And you get no handle on actually measuring these curves by measuring supernova here. You can't distinguish between these curves. So right now, everything's being done there.
These guys want money.
These are being analyzed in the same way that supernova.
Yes. Yes, that's right. The main uncertainty is that you can't get the light curves well enough to really fit that curve to a very high accuracy. And the uncertainty is about 0.2 magnitudes. You can see 0.2 magnitudes is about what it is. As compared to the extrapolated uncertainty because of the chemical compositions, which is 0.05 magnitudes. So that's subdominant. So the difficulty in finding which of those curves is fit in the template and therefore correcting for the absolute brightness is the main formal uncertainty. There could always be a systematic error that we don't know about, but they've worked very hard. And there's two groups doing it, and they get the same result. So, well, what is that result in the terms that we care about? Only they. Yeah, I'll show you in a second.
Okay. For a different region,
a different set of supernovae, but the same redshift. And so this is what we care about, the plot of what omega matter could be versus what omega lambda could be. If you believe in inflation in a flat universe, inflation generally predicts that omega total, which is omega matter plus omega lambda, is 1. So we would like to live on that line if that's what you believed. This is the matter-dominated universe with no cosmological constant. You see it's very far away from the 3 sigma error bars. An open universe with no cosmological constant is also much more than 3 sigma away from where the data lie. Completely consistent with the data is a universe that has an omega matter of about 0.2 or 0.3 and omega lambda of about 0.7 or 0.8. So you could move these error bars around if you believed in unknown systematic errors, but they, once again, I've said they've tried to find such things and can't think of any, but the history of this game is that you always eventually discover unknown systematic errors. But right now it looks good. You're not acting as scandalized by this as you should. This is I don't think you appreciate this yet. Here is the other group's data.
I'm sorry, from that plot comes entirely from that one line of data?
Yeah. Like I say, if you have large error bars in individual points, but you have 15 individual points, you can determine the center of the distribution from which they're taken to very high accuracy. That's right, yeah. As long as it's formal errors, not systematic, yeah. So the equivalent plots from Perlmutter et al. Also have not been published in an actual paper, but here are the ones that they're willing to believe. They have these big error bars. These are the ones that have appeared in Nature. Here are the ones that they show at talks, and they say preliminary analysis, but their error bars are almost exactly the same as the other groups.
But also the center shifted.
The center shifted slightly this way, yes. No. No, this is still omega. This is still omega matter 0.2, omega lambda 0.8. It's a different scale of the graph.
The dash line?
The dash lines are their guess as of January 1998 as to how far they could possibly imagine moving these error bars by some unknown systematic effect. My understanding now is that they're more willing to say that they've ruled this possibility out and they're actually willing to stand by where these error bars really are. But that's just word on the street. That's not anything that has appeared in print yet. So if you're especially bold, you want to accept this, you ask, does it fit in with other things we know about the universe?
Of course, the raven is now more than 10 minutes.
Yeah, I know. You're not going anywhere. Here is some other data from the cosmic microwave background anisotropies of angular scale versus the amount of anisotropy, and there's this famous, the COBE data is over here, there's this famous peak where it rises and goes down. And what is nice is that the location of the peak around an L of 2 or 300 is sensitive to not omega lambda plus omega, sorry, omega matter minus omega lambda is essentially the degeneracy line along which the data I just showed you lie. This is degenerate along omega matter plus omega lambda, so it's orthogonal. And I can show you some theoretical fits so you can judge for yourself what the value is. It's a little bit of a mess, but the fact is that cold dark matter with omega matter equals 1, no omega lambda, has the same location for the peak as a lambda-dominated universe with omega total equals 1, although the height of the peak is different. You can argue amongst yourselves which of these, the blue or the purple curve, fit better, depending on whether you want to throw away the black dots or the pink dots, but they overlap around here, and probably either one are equally good right now. But the open universe curve peaks at a of an L of around 5 or 600, which is outside where this possibly could be if you just sort of boldly fit the location of that peak. So what you can do is plot both of those facts on one graph at the same time. This is a plot that I got from Ned Wright, who has boldly done this. Here are the overlapping error bars from the two supernova searches. They're almost exactly the same. This blue thing are the error bars from the location of the peak in the microwave background, which I said depends on omega matter plus omega lambda. So they're orthogonal, and they meet over here in this little pink region where omega matter is about 0.2, omega lambda is about 0.8. Now, the interesting thing about this is that we've known for other reasons for a long time that measurements of omega matter alone give you around 0.2, between, let's say, 0.1 and 0.4, to be very conservative. So we can put that on the same plot, like that. I show you this because I know for a fact that particle physicists are historically very impressed by three lines intersecting on a plane. And they do. And this is a point which is consistent with, more consistent than any other universe we know of, with other things that I'm not showing you here, with the age of the universe, with the power spectrum, and so forth. People have been, for the last 5 years, writing papers saying this is the best fit universe, but people like me disbelieved them because we thought that they were just trying to write more papers. And it fits everything.
That's this orange band.
The orange band is what you believe from dynamical measurements of the actual matter density from groups of galaxies and so forth.
Yeah.
That's right. So 1998 is the first year of my life when I'm not willing to bet money that we live there at omega matter equals 1.
That's the theorist's point, right?
This is the theorist's favorite point, yes. It's still conceivable that we live here, right? We could live in an open universe. The data are not absolutely unambiguous, especially because as Ned drew this big pink thing, this is his guess as to what the systematic errors could be. So we could live there, but there's a consistency about this point, which is really pretty impressive. And so I'll bring up the happiness now, because for one thing, the people who discovered, you know, did the supernova observations are obviously very happy because they discovered something. They could have found that we just live in a boring open universe. Alan Guth is very happy because he invented inflation. Anyone who believes in inflation is extremely happy because they fit this line very well. Except that there's a few sort of weak-willed revisionists who try to make inflation models that predict the open universes. And they're going to be unhappy because they, you know, they lost the game of chicken. They jumped off the tractor before it hit, and now it's going to be there.
Tom, what happens if I just take Rho and say it's A to some parameter?
We'll do that. That's this. I'll get there.
What do you mean, the strict inflation people just said that black
dot? No,
right?
This is the prediction of inflation, full stop.
Oh, you mean inflation plus epsilon?
Inflation just says the spatial geometry of the universe is flat, except for the weak-willed revisionist who, I keep forgetting that I'm being recorded when I'm saying this, so I want to emphasize that some of my best friends are weak-willed revisionists.
Sean, while you're on the data, could you at least comment on this one observation, which didn't quite fit the sort of observational upper limits on the value of the cosmological constant to the gravitational.
The best way before the supernova data to limit the value of the cosmological constant was to look at frequency of lensing events by gravitational lensing of distant galaxies. And the most bold limit that was put on there was that omega lambda was at 3 sigma level less than 0.65. And it is, well, for one thing, I think that it's overly bold. I think it really should be more like 0.8 or 0.75. But even at the 0.65 level, it's on the edge of being, formally speaking, it's perfectly consistent with these. If you believe in a universe that has omega lambda of a 0.6, for example, and omega matter of 0.4, that's fine. But it certainly indicates that once we get those tests better, we'll be able to check whether or not this is true, because you should be able to find the cosmological constant from the lensing surveys, which are increasing. So the final group, another group of people who should be happy are string theorists and other people who want to invent the theory of everything, because the amount of data we have about how we can fit the theory of everything to the actual world is very small, and every extra piece of information is very precious. And this, if it's true, is actually a very important extra piece of information, that there's a non-zero cosmological constant. And the final set of people who's happy is...
Can you say what no Big Bang
means? Yes, that means that the cosmological constant is so large that if you consider this going to the back, you just curve back up.
It would just go back.
So you never hit the zero. Truth in advertising compels me to say that I am not unbiased. I have a stake in this, which is what makes me happy about the whole thing, because my name appeared on a review article about the cosmological constant, and if it's true, I foresee a citation bonanza. Well, what if it is true? What does that mean? So good, with only half an hour done, I finished number one, which means I'm not going to be able to tell you certain things, but there's certain things that are less crucial than others. What would it mean if there were non-zero cosmological constant? Well, Einstein wrote it down first, and what he wrote down was Einstein's equations, r mu nu minus a half r g mu nu. And he wrote down plus lambda g mu nu, where lambda is the cosmological constant, and added that to his ordinary equations. In the modern world, what we would do is take this term and move it to the right-hand side, and just include this in the energy momentum tensor. So we would write that the energy momentum tensor of the cosmological constant was just given by minus lambda over 8 pi g times the metric. If you take what you know about the energy momentum tensor for a perfect fluid, which is consistent with this equation, and compare it to the right-hand side, what you find is that the energy density in the cosmological constant is just lambda over 8 pi g. So a positive cosmological constant gives you positive energy density. But the pressure associated with this is minus its energy density. So a positive energy density in the vacuum leads to a negative pressure, leads to a tension. In fact, for any time that you have rho sub I evolving with the universe as a to the minus n sub I, you can write that the pressure in that component is n sub I over 3 minus 1 times its energy density. If I got it right, then I should have 0 over 3 minus 1. Yeah, it worked. Okay? So, to get what this means is that to get something which goes away, in order to have the universe be accelerating with time in its expansion, you need a form of energy momentum which redshifts more slowly than the curvature, which means that n sub I has to be between minus 2 and 0. And therefore, that's going to mean that there's a negative pressure in that stuff. So that's one thing you have to keep in mind if you want to invent theories that explain this. What does it mean to have a negative pressure? Well, it does not mean that there's... A negative pressure is, of course, a tension. It pulls things together. But you're not actually going to feel any tension from the vacuum pressure, because what matters is pressure differences. And since it's the vacuum pressure, you're not going to have any differences in pressure from one point to another. However, when you plug in to the equation here, the equation here, you find the universe is accelerating. This is why Science Magazine and other disreputable places have called it anti-gravity, because it makes the expansion of the universe accelerate. It is not anti-gravity. There's no way you can bunch up extra vacuum energy and, you know, put it in your sneakers to make you jump higher and increase your vertical leap. You will not replace Air Jordans with false vacuum Jordans or anything like that. Furthermore, if you had a region of false vacuum that, like, was a spherical region, two of them. You can't do this, of course, but if you had zero vacuum energy here and positive vacuum energy here, these two regions would pull each other together. They would have an attractive force between them, not a repulsive force. So So it is honestly, to God, not anti-gravity. It is also not a fifth force. That's another thing it has been called. It's gravity, which is one of the top four forces. It's either first or fourth, depending on your list of priorities. But it's not a new one. What it is very unnatural. This is why everyone is so surprised, why a year ago or 2 months ago I would have bet you money that it was not going to be there. And it's unnatural for two reasons. First, because what it should be, the cosmological constant is something that you can estimate what its value should be, and you find a number which is much, much bigger than the actual number you get. Therefore, people believe that since it's so much smaller than what you think it should be, it's easier in the space of all possible theories to imagine theories which set it exactly to zero than a theory which sets it pretty small but not zero. You may or may not be convinced by that argument, but that is what the argument is. The second one is that omega lambda, the contribution of lambda to the energy density of the universe, changes with time, and it would be very fine-tuned to have it just appear important right now. So let me talk a little bit about those two things. First, the problem, the cosmological constant problem, why it is so much smaller than we would expect it to be. The point is that there are a lot of contributions to the energy density of the vacuum. In general relativity and in quantum field theory, we would not expect the energy density of the vacuum to be zero. We'd expect it to be a very, very big number. If you think about a harmonic oscillator with the potential V of x, 1/2 omega squared x squared, the minimum energy density, the minimum energy for that harmonic oscillator classically is zero, but in quantum mechanics, you write that the zero-point energy is 1/2 h bar omega. In field theory, you can think of a massless scalar field as an infinite number of harmonic oscillators spread all over space-time, and you add up the zero-point energies of all these things, and you get something which goes to infinity. If you put it in a box and let the box size go to infinity, you get an infinite vacuum energy. That is not the cosmological constant problem, because we could always have defined the potential to be this minus 1/2 h bar omega, and then we would have gotten a zero vacuum energy. In other words, we can renormalize it away. We can set it to zero. The actual cosmological constant problem is that in the real world, there are many different things which contribute to the vacuum energy. There are the zero-point energies like this of many different fields of all different masses in the standard model, so there's complicated functions that you have to integrate and cut off in some undetermined way. Plus, there is the bare cosmological constant, whatever is sitting there in Lagrangian as a constant term. Plus, when a scalar field gets a vacuum expectation value and has some potential, then that potential energy acts as a vacuum energy, and these are all contributing to this. So how do you get all of these apparently independent contributions to add up to something very small? The reason why it's very small is because if you did something like this and guessed at how big it should be, the only cutoff that is natural to put on it is the Planck scale, in which case lambda, which is has units of mass to the fourth, you would guess is approximately, so lambda guess looks like the Planck mass to the fourth power, which is 10 to the 18 GeV to the fourth power. It's either 18 or 19, depending on whether you where to put the two pi's, but I like 18 because it'll make my formulas more pretty. What you observe as an upper limit is approximately 10 to the minus 3 electron volts to the fourth. So lambda guess over lambda observed is 10 to the 120, which is, you know, this is a big difference. Of course, it's cheating because 10 to the 120 is really just 10 to the 30 to the fourth power, since the units are mass to the fourth. The actual difference in mass scale is only off by 30 orders of magnitude, but still it's very far away from what you'd expect. So you need some mechanism to set this to zero. We don't know what that mechanism is. It's easier to imagine a mechanism which sets it exactly to zero. I don't know how easy it is because we haven't yet imagined such mechanisms. But you want to set it to zero, and you don't want it to set it to zero for all time because you want it to change with time, for instance, because you want a vacuum energy during inflation to make the universe bigger. So no one has any good idea about how that could happen. I was going to talk about what some of the ideas are, but I clearly don't have time to do that. The second point is that it is fine-tuned. It changes with time. And that's easy to see because if you take omega, the contribution of the energy density in the cosmological constant to omega, and compare it to the matter contribution, then by the formulas I gave you before, that's just the energy density in each divided by each other. This goes as a to the 0. This goes as a to the minus 3. So this goes as a cubed. It changes rapidly with time as the universe expands. So if you want the cosmological constant to be 0.7 today, omega sub lambda, then this is the graph of omega matter and omega lambda as functions of time. As functions, actually, of the log of the scale factor. I think it's important to take the log because the first 3 seconds of the universe are much more important than the most recent 3 seconds. So this is what happens. Omega lambda in the past is extremely close to 0. It has to leap up right now as far as the log of the scale factor is concerned. And we have to be located right there. An equivalent way to show it, which might actually be even more clear, is take the derivative of this. The derivative of omega lambda is 0 here, and large in between. So if you plot that, you're going to get something that looks almost like a delta function. And you have to believe that we landed right in the middle of the spike, which is kind of unlikely. I mean, that's why for a long time, whenever people said I've detected the cosmological constant, they would say, well, let's wait and see. And that's still true. You should still wait and see. But it's becoming harder to keep waiting because the data are getting better and better. But that is why people didn't believe it for a long time. Furthermore, the matter energy density in such a universe as omega matter is 0.3. But we have an upper limit on the energy density in the baryons, the stuff we actually see, of about 0.05. So in such a universe, you not only need to believe in omega lambda vacuum energy of 0.7, you also have to believe in an invisible non-baryonic cold dark matter component to make omega matter of omega cold dark matter of about 0.25. So you have to invoke the tooth fairy more than once to have a universe that we can believe in, which is very distressing. We were hoping to, you know, observe the universe and see a nice minimalist Mark Rothko. We've discovered that we live in a Jackson Pollock painting, and it's very disconcerting. So, yeah, well, we don't even want to talk about K is not even conclusion. I mean, no one believes that. That would be ridiculous. Well, what if it is non-zero? What does that mean? There's two possibilities, basically. One is that it just is non-zero. That, you know, the vacuum energy is not zero, and you have to live with it. You have to invent a theory that tells me why it's the tiny value that it has. I don't have any such theories, but the energy density you need, lambda, observe, well, I should write it as the energy density in lambda that you need to explain these observations is of the order of 10 to the minus 3 electron volts to the fourth. And I will note for your edification that the geometric mean of the Planck mass and this is 1 TeV, 10 to the 3 GeV, which is the, as everyone knows, the supersymmetry breaking scale. So this plus $2.25 will buy you a double latte. If I had a theory that predicted this, I wouldn't be standing here talking to you. I'd be going and writing the paper. And if anyone else, on the basis of my telling you this, is inspired to come up with a theory, then I'd be happy to collaborate on writing up the results. The other possibility is that the absolute value of the energy density is zero. But we don't live in the absolute minimum of the energy density. We live in a false vacuum. So we live in a world with some potential that looks like this, and there's some scalar field that takes on a potential, takes on a value, and we live here. And this is separated from here by 10 to the minus 3 electron volts to the fourth. Why would that be? I have no idea why would that be. People have written papers suggesting that it's true. In a lot of theories, you can write down, after inflation, you fall into one of several different possible vacuum states, and they can have different values of the cosmological constant. You would have to explain that it's at least as likely or more likely that we live in the non-zero value of the cosmological constant than in the zero one, and you would have to explain why the difference between them is so small. I don't know. People try to do it, but nothing really convincing yet. The final possibility is the, well, it's much bigger than the age of the universe, so that's not the problem. I don't think that's the problem, but it depends on what your views on the next thing I want to mention, which is the anthropic principle. which the anthropic principle is a very sensible idea. It says that if you have a universe with various different conditions throughout the universe, then you would not expect intelligent life to grow up in the most typical place of the universe. For example, in the solar system, the surface area of the sun is much larger than the surface area of the Earth, but no one is surprised that we grew up on Earth rather than the sun, because it's not a very hospitable place to live. If you believed that the universe had different areas, either in space or in time or in branches of the wave function, in which the cosmological constant took on different values, then you could argue that the value of the cosmological constant that we would observe has to be the one which is consistent with the existence of intelligent life. People who have much better paying jobs than me take this very seriously. I can't say anything about it, but personally, I'm not quite sure that we know the conditions under which intelligent life forms, and I'm very sure that we don't know for sure that there are different values of the cosmological constant in different portions of the universe. So I would hope that that is not the explanation.
Sean, I do too, but you have no Big Bang curve on your plot, and the anthropic prediction is number on the order of 1/2 of that value.
You have to give them credit. The people who write papers on the anthropic principle predicted a cosmological constant of the order that we apparently observe. How do they do that? The point is that if this is the curve, then much earlier than now, we had not enough time for life to evolve. Much later than now, all the stars will have died and life will not be around. So you cut down the possible places you could be on this graph to a region that is in between here and here. And that's just not that unlikely. And you put an upper limit on what the value of the cosmological constant could be for life to evolve, and you get that it's about 5 times the size of the matter density, which is what you get.
Sean, am I understanding you to say that that peak is necessarily in the region between much earlier than now and much later than now? It couldn't, for example, live entirely in much earlier than now?
Yes. If it were much earlier than now, after this peak, then the universe is dominated by a cosmological constant. If that were true, then galaxies never would have formed.
But the galaxy formation bound is nothing like 5 times the current matter density. It's more like 100.
Well, it's changed with time. I think that...
I had the thought that Princeton comes from cosmology and like 150, I think.
150?
Yeah, one more than cosmology.
It depends. Yeah, I've seen values that range from 5 to 100. I have not seen 150 for the ratio of the energy density in the vacuum to matter. And I think that the distinction arises in how, in whether or not you go a posteriori or a priori for other observational constraints. In other words, you can write a paper saying, given what we already know, which is that omega lambda is not 100 times omega matter, what is the most likely value for it to have, given the anthropic principle? I know you shouldn't do that, but like I say, people with much higher salaries than me, and I can show you the papers. So I don't believe it, so I can't really defend it effectively. They often assume that it can't be negative, but it is non-symmetric, sure. Yeah, different values for negative cosmological constants and positive cosmological constants. Yeah. Yeah, okay. There's not much to say if the cosmological constant is non-zero at this point of the game. I don't know of any theory that predicted it to be that big except for the anthropic principle, which is somewhat less than a full theory. The other option is that something like this is going on, that we live in a universe which we are not living in the true vacuum. We have a non-zero energy density here, but we are changing with time so that the absolute value of the cosmological constant is a time-dependent thing and will eventually go to zero. The simplest way to do that is to have a scalar field. So I'm on here now. The simplest way to do that is to have a scalar field which has some potential and the scalar field is rolling. There are more complicated ways to do that, which I would have loved to explain to you in detail, but I'll have to just mention very briefly. Some of the more esoteric proposals are, number one, that you have cosmic strings, which are at an energy density attention for the cosmic string at the electroweak scale, so much lighter than what you would need to perturb the universe and make large-scale structure. But you imagine the cosmic strings do not intercommute, so that when one string, if you have two strings crossing each other, these do not go, ordinarily they would go into something like this, and just move apart. But if you imagine that they look like this, there's another string that was born in between them, then the energy density in the system would redshift more slowly than the energy density in the ordinary system. And what you find is that you can, it was proposed that this could be the missing mass of the universe and would redshift more slowly. Yes. In fact, that's the sad thing these days, is that this is rho string goes like a to the minus 2, which is just like an open universe. And if you actually believe the data, that's not consistent with the data, because it does not help you any more than an open universe did. But it kind of looks like a little D-brain, so it's kind of neat, because you could imagine, well. And the other possibility is that there's a texture which wraps around the universe. In other words, there are scalar fields whose gradient energy fills the universe, and it wraps around the universe in such a way that it can't just unwind. And that would tend to give you also an energy density which scales as a to the minus 2, so it has the same problem. Also, it appears to be unstable to small perturbations in the most recent investigations. But the people who've worked on that have not added higher derivative terms like they do in skirmions and so forth. So there's still the possibility that could be true, although I don't think anyone's looked at the possibility. Okay, so let's go on to the more respectable things, which are scalar fields, changing with time. It turns out to be very easy. There are lots of scalar fields around. And I should point out, by the way, that if it is true that there's some scalar field, which is slowly varying with time, that dominates the energy density of the universe, then you know the excitations in the scalar field are not the important thing. It's really a very low temperature. It's a classical kind of thing. So if this is true, there's a real sense in which the universe is dominated by a Bose-Einstein condensate. So I want to fit everyone in here to the excitement. So if you have a scalar field that is in some potential, it follows an equation of motion that looks like phi double dot plus 3 a dot over a, which is just the Hubble parameter, phi dot plus the slope of the potential equals 0. And this term here acts like a friction. The phi double dot plus this would be an unforced field rolling back and forth in its potential, but it is slowed down by the expansion of the universe. So it can slow down so much that it gets essentially into the slow rolling regime, just like it would during inflation. And then the dominant form of its energy momentum density is not phi dot, but v of phi, right over here. So the simplest possibility is to guess that v of phi, the point is we want it to be non-zero now, we want it to be rolling, we want it to be zero eventually. So let's imagine it just rolls off to infinity. So take v of phi to be v0 divided by phi. Now, you might be shocked. You've never seen a potential like that before. But you have if you've worked on supersymmetric models. There's some supersymmetric models in which it's very easy to get non-perturbative potentials for directions which would otherwise be flat, but the flatness is lifted by instanton effects, and you get things that look like 1 over phi. In fact, if you read the paper by Aspect 9 and Seiberg, where they talked about these things for the first time, they found potentials that look like this. And a lesser set of particle physicists would have said, well, this doesn't achieve any vacuum state, so it's just nonsense. But what they actually said in their paper was, it does not achieve any vacuum state, so it must have, at best, a cosmological interpretation. So it pays to be very smart. Well, what happens? You can solve, if this is true, you can ask, well, what parameters in the potential V0 would you need to get an energy density today that would mimic a cosmological constant? And you can do that. Let me first tell you what the evolution is. In a matter-dominated regime, what you get is that the energy density in phi compared to the energy density in matter is proportional to the time to the 4/3. Don't ask me why this is true. To the 4/3, which is the scale factor squared. So it rapidly catches up. You have to imagine in the very early universe, the energy density in phi was much smaller than the energy density in matter, which is good, because you know that phi could not have been important, for example, during Big Bang nucleosynthesis. So this is nice. Once you are phi-dominated, then phi goes as t to the 2/5. So phi is rolling down its potential, but it's not rolling very quickly. And what this means is that rho phi goes as the log of the scale factor to the minus a half. This is all work just hours ago, so I don't trust it. And the scale factor itself goes as e to the t to the 4/5. The point of writing this down is to show you this is almost De Sitter space. If you were truly vacuum dominated, you would have a going as e to the t. This is a little bit slower expansion than that. Similarly, the energy density here is not quite constant, but it's declining very, very, very slowly. So it looks a lot like De Sitter space. If you look at the very future evolution of such a universe, it would get bigger and bigger and be expanding faster and faster and get less and less dense as time went on and become a very empty and dull place. But for that to happen, you can plug in what the parameters need to be for the slow roll conditions to be satisfied and so forth. And what you get is that phi today is approximately the Planck scale. And it's not surprising. I mean, you say, did quantum gravity have something to do with this? But the Planck, since I'm setting h bar equal to 1, the Planck scale is just a funny way of writing 1 over the square root of Newton's constant. And Newton's constant obviously is important in this game. And then the parameter and the potential necessary to get this to happen is 10 to the 3, that's right, 10 to the 3 electron volts to the fifth, has dimensions of mass to the fifth. So this is small. I don't know where this would come from, but who knows. And you wanted to find a mass of the phi particle, which you can't really do, because the mass of particle is something you define when it's sitting at the bottom of a potential oscillating back and forth. But nevertheless, you can boldly take the square root of the second derivative of its potential, call that the mass. It does give you some idea of how easy it is to push the field around. And you get a value of 10 to the minus 33 electron volts, which is not coincidentally the Hubble constant today. So there's a slight problem with these, which is that we don't expect it to be possible to take a field like this and have it completely ignore the rest of the universe. It should be coupled at least a little bit to other things in the cosmos. So, for example, phi today being the Planck scale, we might imagine that in the effective Lagrangian for phi, it couples to the Ricci scalar. So the effective gravitational constant today would have a contribution from phi. And phi today being of the Planck scale means that it is at least as important as any constant value that we have in there for Newton's constant. So we could put limits on whether or not this is possible by looking at time variations in the gravitational constant. Basically, yes. That's what I'm just going to say. The limit is, observationally, that Newton's constant varies on a time scale of less than or equal to 10 to the minus 11 per year, whereas this guy, phi, whereas the prediction is, this is the theory, the prediction from this, if phi contributes directly with a coupling constant of unit 1 to g, you would predict that, let me write it as g dot over g as a function of phi or something like that, you'd predict approximately 10 to the minus 10 per year, because that's basically the inverse Hubble constant, the age of the universe.
And
so
that's
right. That's the next thing I'm going to say. I worried about this, and all of these, the worries I'm going to tell you about seem to have not been noticed by the large number of papers that are written on time-varying cosmological constants. So now that it's become more important in explaining the data, I think people are going to have to start worrying about this, and they haven't yet. This is something I worried about and noticed that it's very close to the limit. But you could imagine there's coupling constants of order unity which save you, and maybe you could have an important discovery if you keep improving these bounds. But also, you would expect that these things would couple to other things, not just gravitationally, but with gravitational strength, but perhaps with different strengths, approximately gravitational strengths, but differently to different particles. And if you look at the mass of this guy, it's very, very small. It's essentially of infinite range. And infinite range scalar fields, which couple with gravitational strength, as actually Tom pointed out to me, are just ruled out. In fact, the limit is that if you imagine that there's some wavelength, there's some range of a force of gravitational strength that couples to stuff, it's randomly that couples, for instance, to baryon number, but not equally to everything else, the lambda has to be less than about 1 millimeter, or less than 10 to the minus, what is the number, 6, 10 to the minus 4 electron volts, 1 over 10 to the minus 4 electron volts. So any particle that is almost massless and going to couple with gravitational strength to other things better have a mass which is greater than 10 to the minus 4 electron volts. But the effective mass of this is 10 to the minus 33 electron volts. So this is very incompatible if those arguments are true. Those arguments are kind of hand-wavy, so you could imagine that there's some symmetry that protects everything. But you have to stretch your imagination, and it's certainly something to worry about if you believe that this kind of explanation is going to do things for you. So there's two more possibilities I want to run by you very quickly. One is just to notice that you could do the same exact thing, but instead of this weird potential, V goes as 1 over phi, you could just put V goes as m squared phi squared. It works just as well. you plug in the values and you find that M has to be around the Planck, no, that the value of phi today has to be around the Planck scale and M has to be around the Hubble constant in order to, the same thing. Phi squared. In other words, you have your potential here, V of phi, you're sitting here, so it wants to roll down, but the height above ground of that little thing is so very, very, very tiny that this has been freezing it. It's overdamped for the entire history of the universe until now, when the Hubble constant has decreased, and this is sort of set free and can now roll. It has exactly the same problems as the previous model in that it's an infinite range scalar field and it couples to things, so you worry about it. It has one important difference over the previous model in that once it is allowed to roll, it will settle down to the minimum of its potential and rock back and forth. So it is not true that in this model the universe necessarily expands forever almost exponentially. The universe could be closed in this model and actually recollapse eventually because this will become like a matter-dominated universe once this thing starts oscillating back and forth. So strictly speaking, the interpretation of the new results of saying the universe will expand forever is not quite true. You could imagine ways to get around that, even if it's expanding faster and faster today. So the final thing I want to say is, finally I get to my own stuff, which is quintessence. Quiescence is being quiet. Quintessence is the fifth element, like Bruce Willis talked about in his movie. And it's the name that Steinhardt and his collaborators have used for anything that changes with time but evolves with an n between 0 and 2. Something that acts like a cosmological constant, roughly speaking. This is all examples of quintessence, yes. It's also called X matter. I think quintessence is going to win. I don't know if either one of them is going to win. I would be surprised if either one of them wins. With Greg Anderson, I've been working on a model which has a scalar field which has a potential that looks like 1 over phi, but it also has another particle in it, which we call psi, which gets a mass from the vacuum expectation value of phi. There's nothing wrong with that. That's what the Higgs particle does to ordinary stuff. Imagine that this is true, and imagine further that there is some number density of psi particles in the universe. Then, even though phi wants to roll down this potential, it will eventually cost energy for phi to increase because the ambient energy density in the particles that it's giving mass to goes up. So there's a contribution to this potential, which is linear in phi, and it's proportional to... practice that for years. I mean, that's not something... it's proportional to the number density in psi particles that you have. So in any fixed number density, there are two contributions. You can add them up, and you find an equilibrium point somewhere here, and this becomes the vacuum expectation value of phi. In an expanding universe, the number density of the ambient particles is not a constant. It goes down as the universe gets bigger and bigger. So you get another linear curve that looks like that. You get another effective potential that looks like that. You find another vacuum expectation value. So as the universe expands, the vacuum expectation value of phi increases with time. The mass of the psi particles increase with time. The energy density of the psi particles decreases with the scale factor more slowly than 1 over a cubed, because if the number density going down is 1 over a cubed, but the individual masses go up. So in fact, what you find is that, and plus there's energy density in phi itself. There's a vacuum energy in phi, just as you had before. In fact, for the simple values of the potential that I chose, the energy density in psi particles is equal to exactly the energy density in phi, and they go as a to the minus 3 halves. So it's an example of something that redshifts in between ordinary matter and the cosmological constant. And there's a clause in the contract of the cosmologist that says you have to come up with a cute name. These are variable mass particles, or vamps. Some people got it just because, you know. So this is our name. It only applies to ours, but I think that for ours it will fit better. Well, what are the parameters that you need? Part of the good news, there's two pieces of good news with this model, and one piece of extraordinarily bad news, which I'll tell you last. There's the two pieces of good news is, well, one piece of bad news, which I didn't tell you explicitly, but you could have figured out, is with the previous models of a slowly rolling scalar field, you had the same problem that you still need cold dark matter in the model, because those scalar fields are not going to collect in galaxies. They're just too long wavelength. So to explain the dark matter in galaxies, you still need to introduce yet another component. Here, you have these side particles, which are very, which become more and more massive as the universe expands. And they cool off very rapidly. They can easily collect in galaxies. You could imagine explaining everything by these side particles. In other words, you could have omega vamp equals 0.95, omega baryon equals 0.05, at least in principle. You'd have to check. But that actually gives you good microwave background predictions and so forth. But it's possible. There's nothing wrong with it. The other good thing is when you plug in the numbers for the potentials, what you find is that the mass of the psi particle today is around 100 electron volts. The mass of the phi particle today is around 10 to the minus 6 electron volts. And the potential has a parameter in it, which is 10 to the minus 2 electron volts to the fifth. So this guy gives you no problem in terms of long-range forces. 10 to the minus 6 is less than 10 to the minus 4, but this value is for a typical point in the universe. And these numbers are density dependent. If you're in a galaxy, as we are, the number density of psi particles will be higher than a typical point of the universe. Therefore, the mass of psi will be lower, but the mass of phi will be higher. So this is going to be greater than that, and you can imagine avoiding those bounds. That is the second piece of good news, that it's not obviously inconsistent with long-range forces and time variations of coupling constant types of arguments. And the value of phi, did I write down what the value of phi is? The value if I needed is much, much less than the Planck scale, so variations in Newton's constant are not a problem. The problem with it is that these arguments I told you about the equilibrium point and the vacuum expectation value are only true if I enforce strictly that the energy density, the number density of the psi particles is homogeneous, does not vary with space. But if I ask what happens when I slightly perturb that from homogeneity, those perturbations grow rapidly. It's dramatically unstable to small spatial perturbations, which is a ramification of the fact that there's a negative pressure, that the particles, once you change the pressure with space and time, they're going to fall into the gravitational, the phi potential wells very, very rapidly. So you can ask, well, is it rapidly enough to be inconsistent with observation? As far as I can tell, the answer is yes. And Doug Early and I have been thinking about ways to fix it up. The way to fix it up would be to add extra fields to the theory, which have a repulsive force, which keep the psi particles away from each other. So that would protect them from dramatically falling in. And actually, Doug has been doing it. I've been encouraging him. But we don't know what the answer is yet. At some point, even if you got a model that worked, you would have to add so many fields that the dramatic gain you had in simplicity was offset by the fact that you needed 12 scalar fields and several gauge fields with different charges to make the whole thing work. So we don't know if it works right now, but certainly any one of these models or a cosmological constant which was true and the actual answer would be an extremely exciting thing, something for the theory of everything to explain, and the promise of more exciting cosmology in the future. Thank you.
That was superb. I've got a lot of questions. I'd like to
before. You're the director.
Is there any hope ever of measuring lambda dot?
Sure. Any hope ever? I mean, the answer is always yes. Oh, your lifetime. Well, my lifetime. Who says that will be longer than your lifetime? You can see that if we really get the systematics under control, these are going to... This is the difference between a lambda-dominated universe and an open universe. So one in which n is 0, one in which n is 2. It is certainly not inconceivable to me that we could rule out a universe for which n is 3 halves, for example. If n goes to 0.001, then obviously there's some regime in which you cannot possibly get it. But I think that for reasonable values of lambda dot, yes, it's certainly quite conceivable.
If lambda is time dependent,
yes, and in fact, that is essentially what you're doing. I mean, you're not directly just measuring the second derivative here. You're measuring some combination. By measuring, as Tony suggested, different supernovae different redshifts, you get handles on different combinations of A double dot and A triple dot. And if you really mapped out this curve exactly, then yes. The closer you get, the better. I mean,
you could make a lambda the whole time. But is it, so what I was asking, is it conceivable the next 20 years, 30 years, one could imagine measuring the A triple dot?
Well, let me give you. Remember, the other thing, the other way to constrain things like this is to look at gravitational lens statistics. And one of the interesting things is that the behavior of the probability that you will lens something with time is very different as a function of redshift in a lambda-dominated universe versus a quintessence-dominated universe or something like that. Although it appears that I haven't brought with me a little view graph. Huh. Outrageous. The point is, I remember what it looked like. The point is that if you plot the optical depth for lensing versus redshift, then for then the shape of the curves depends on n, on how fast you redshift. So I had a plot with three curves for different values of the cosmological constant, and then one curve for a vamp-dominated universe with omega vamp of 0.95, and it looks like this. This is fragile. So if you were actually able to map out the number of gravitational lenses as a function of redshift, that would give you an independent handle on these things. So over the course of 20 years, stuff like this, I bet, will give us enough independent handles that we'll get a pretty good idea of what the actual behavior A as a function of time is. I'm pretty optimistic, but that's a 20-year thing, not a 2-year thing.
Now, the other question I wanted to ask you was whether you had any comment on the recent attempts to use quantum cosmology to say something about reason
parameters. You need more comment than that? There's a recent claim that the wave function of the universe gives you a distribution of values for the cosmological constant, which, together with the anthropic principle, predicts that the universe is open. No, I'm sorry. Yeah, that, I misspoke. They didn't have the cosmological constant in there. They had the density parameter. So the prediction was, this is what makes me so happy about it, the prediction was the universe is open. Which is ruled out. Hawking and Ferroth wrote a paper. It was on TV in England anyway. And and Linde wrote a paper saying it was wrong, and Belenkin wrote a paper saying he didn't do it either. And, but I mean, when you read a paper, it's just the anthropic principle again. So I mean, whether or not it's right, I don't think they're new. It's a different version of this, a similar thing. It's a, it needs some actualizing force when you want to use the anthropic principle. You need some way for these parameters to vary, and that's what they've done. Yeah.
Do any of these models you've talked about in which lambda's not really get around the fact that you live in a very special point, a special, very special time in the universe where these energy densities are?
A little bit. If you're going to have the energy density change, not quite, the difference between energy change in stuff is not quite as different than matter as the cosmological constant is, then the width of this spike is going to be larger. So the unnaturalness you need to live in that spike is less. For example, if you believe this curve is the one for the pure cosmological constant, then one that goes as a to the minus 3 has looks like this. It's a little bit thicker. Still unnatural. I would not count this as a success. But, you know, you got to live somewhere. It's not
that's
better.
That's the problem, right?
Yeah.
The data tells you have two different contributions which behave differently with the tail back. So one of them...
Essentially,
is
yes.
The other,
that's right. Yeah. I mean, after all, there was a point around here where omega matter went from being 0 to 1, and omega radiation went from being 1 to 0. The The thing is not that there is a spike and that we live in it. It's just that the spike is really so thin. So increasing the thickness of the spike really is an improvement. But these are all, I mean, these are all just things to give you a state of mind that you use to figure out what you want to work on or worry about, right? But if you measure it not to be zero, then all the graphs in the world aren't going to save you. You have to work on it.
So actually, there's one comment is that in most of these theories, you have to use parameters, for instance, like Enoch, and there's always, you know, some concern about exactly where those things are coming from. So in particular, I think there's actually one class of models in which, it, you know, other than the ones that you spoke about, that you can also hope to get a reasonable value for the parameter. And that's if you consider, for instance, the finite temperature Seesaw model of neutrino masses. And if you consider the effective potential there, then there are scalar fields which interact with neutrinos. And if you calculate their effective potential, the height of the potential is equal to m mu to the power 4. And then if you believe m mu is from the solution of
Yeah, I should have said that. I meant to say that. But just in a more general statement that what Anupam just said is that if you look at this energy density in the vacuum that you need, it's 10 to the minus 3 electron volts to the 4th. And 10 to the minus 3 electron volts by itself is what you might expect mass in the neutrino to be in various Seesaw models. So you can try to build models in which those two numbers are related to each other. And it has been done, and that's an example. So that's another thing that you might guess. That would explain the difference, right, in the energy between two false vacuum. But there would still be a zero energy vacuum? Or
So there's a question of, so if you write out the generic potential for these things, there's going to be a height, and then there's going to be the zero point energy, of course. And the generic statement, you know, would be that if you were not doing fine tuning, the height of the potential and zero point energy should be comparable with each other. That, of course, opens up a whole Pandora's box of problems, other problems for you. But I mean, if you, which you have to solve, used to be the statement that you know that was a fine tuning. The reverse of it was a fine-tuning problem. But I think if you just write down the effective potential, you get a point energy and then the height of the potential, and those two should be comparable. And you can actually do the time evolution in these models, and you get things consistent.
And today it would show that this is a non-time-dependent cosmological constant.
Well, so actually, if you do the full time evolution, there's a period for which there's time evolution, and then it asymptotes to a time-independent thing.
Okay. Yeah. Clifford?
Going back to observations, within the current understanding of astrophysics and our own technology, are there any better standard candles than the supernovae?
Not that I know of at this point. There's certainly other people who are trying to do it independently. You will read claims that people from the expansion of radio lobes in active radio galaxies are able to sort of triangulate standard rulers and get similar accuracy. I don't believe that the accuracy really is similar, because in that case, effects you don't understand on evolution and things like that are much more obviously a potential problem. Yeah, I mean, and I don't know of anything that is more likely to be an accurate standard candle to the level of 0.05 magnitude than type 1A supernova. And it has to be really bright, too, right? You have to be able to see it. So things that are that bright, we would notice. So there can't be that many of them. Tom?
Yeah, I wanted to get back to this question of fine-tuning and time.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned the question that I wanted to ask. If we were living right now at the time when we were going between matter domination and radiation domination, and I drew a graph like the one you drew, would I also see a spike?
Mm-hmm.
And
say, yeah.
We're living in a really special time?
Yeah, but we don't live in that spike.
Yeah, I know. We happen not to live in that spike.
That's right.
Who's been
well, we couldn't have lived in that spike.
You're using the anthropic principle?
Yeah.
I'm using biochemistry.
Same thing. No, I think that that's right. I think that, but I don't think that it really alters my mindset about anything. I mean, there are spikes. That's true. Someone, you have to live somewhere. The question is, If you happen to live in the thinnest spike, then that's a little bit surprising. If there's only two spikes, and one of them's thick and one of them's thin, and you live in a really thin one, then that's, I mean, no one is surprised when there is a spike that we don't live in.
There are two different power laws, right? And we're asking when
Well, there's a couple, I mean, what can I say? There's a couple things. The spike for matter radiation domination is much more broad because rho radiation over rho matter goes as a to the minus 1, not a to the minus 3. So it would be less surprising had we lived there. The fact that it existed and we don't live there is not at all surprising. So it's so I think that it's still surprising that we live inside the lambda spike. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Could you comment something about the systematics of what could go wrong with the initial matter?
With the supernovae?
With the supernovae. For instance, how would lensing influence?
Well, I love it when I have straight men in the audience. Here is a error budget for the supernova measurements. These are the best guesses. Not best guesses. These are the educated estimations of the high redshift supernova team for the error budget for their previous work, which had four very high redshift supernovae. In very small print, but I will read the numbers out loud. So, of course, the more recent stuff, because the paper doesn't exist, I can't show you, but this should be comparable. This is the estimated errors in magnitudes for the absolute brightness of these supernovae. And the different ones I would point out are, one is evolution, and this is the attempt to correct for different metallicities, and they estimate that it's about 0.06 magnitudes, independent of how far away it is. Another one is the light curve fit, and this is what I told Joe is the actual source of error, as high as 0.2 magnitudes, as low as 0.08 magnitudes, no, as high as 0.42 magnitudes. But there are two different independent methods for doing it, and there's nothing wrong when you have two independent methods for doing something for using the one with the smaller error bars, because that's presumably more accurate. So the errors are always less than 0.21 magnitudes, which is those error bars that you saw. That's the dominant source. The intrinsic dispersion of supernovae, even if you fit the light curves, is about 0.12. So that's another important contribution, not the most important, but these two are the ones that count. Evolution is not. Lensing is one that you mentioned, and that's 0.02 magnitudes, as high as 0.04 magnitudes for very, very far away. So it's there, but it's not dominant.
Let me see if I understand. Empirically, there are no real constraints on, the data suggests that there's some form of matter with m not equal to 3.
Less than 3.
Less than 3. With n less than 3, but it could be anywhere between 3 and 0.
Less than 2 if you believe an open universe is ruled out. An open universe would be 2. So between 2 and 0 to make it. The claim is, which is a believable claim in my opinion, that they've discovered that the expansion of the universe is getting faster and faster. And that means n is less than 2. Tony, do you have a question or no?
Not really, but maybe in line with Anupam's remark, you know, they're talking about Ophiuchus back in the days of the induced gravity, people talking about time varying cosmic. It's very similar.
Yeah, it's the same thing. Yeah, that's right. You can move by conformal transformations, you can move around these scalar fields from the gravity sector to the matter sector.
Sure. Whatever. Oh, that's